Our gospel reading this morning comes from the Gospel of Matthew. Last week we read in Matthew's gospel of Joseph being told in a dream not to fear taking Mary as his wife, that the two of them together would face the shame, the ostracizement, if that's a word, that comes from a scandalous pregnancy. The child was born in Bethlehem in Matthew's gospel with little fanfare. And then sometime later, a week, a month, a year, or two, or three, something else happens.
In the time of King Herod, after Jesus was born in Bethlehem of Judea, wise men from the east came to Jerusalem, asking, "Where is the child who has been born King of the Jews? For we observed his star at its rising and have come to pay him homage." When King Herod heard this, he was frightened, and all Jerusalem with him. And calling together all the chief priests and scribes of the people, he inquired of them where the Messiah was to be born. They told him, "In Bethlehem of Judea, for so it has been written by the prophet, 'And you, Bethlehem, in the land of Judah, are by no means least among the rulers of Judah, for from you shall come a ruler who is to shepherd my people Israel.'" Then Herod secretly called for the wise men and learned from them the exact time when the star had appeared. Then he sent them to Bethlehem, saying, "Go and search diligently for the child, and when you have found him, bring me word so that I may also go and pay him homage." When they had heard the king, they set out, and there, ahead of them, went the star that they had seen at its rising, until it stopped over the place where the child was. When they saw that the star had stopped, they were overwhelmed with joy. On entering the house, they saw the child with Mary, his mother, and they knelt down and paid him homage. Then, opening their treasure chests, they offered him gifts of gold, frankincense, and myrrh. And having been warned in a dream not to return to Herod, they left for their own country by another road. Now, after they had left, an angel of the Lord appeared to Joseph in a dream and said, "Get up, take the child and his mother, and flee to Egypt, and remain there until I tell you, for Herod is about to search for the child to destroy him." Then Joseph got up, took the child and his mother by night, and went to Egypt, and remained there until the death of Herod.
Thank you, Joshua. So, how many of y'all still have your bracelets after 2 weeks? Look at that, a bunch. This is awesome. If you missed it and you're going, "What are we talking about? Are we doing jewelry now in church?" These bracelets were something we passed out a couple of weeks ago as a tool to help us have a more meaningful Advent, and I've got several more in a bowl up here if you need some. A more meaningful Advent means, in the context of the bracelets, one that is not marked by complaints, criticisms, sarcasm, or snark. Now, most of us went, "What's left?" But the way it worked with this snappy little bracelet was that if you found yourself complaining or criticizing, we notice it, which is a big thing. We stop, which is an even bigger thing. We forgive ourselves, and we move the bracelet over to the other wrist and start afresh. Now, I've gotten to hear a few stories from folks in person and via email, and there's even folks who've been passing them out to coworkers and friends when they've heard about this goofy thing that we're doing at the church. As one person kindly said, the bracelet's a little gimmicky, but it helps us notice not just, well, I can only speak for me, but it's not so much that it helps me notice unwelcome behaviors that I participate in, but more important, it also has helped me notice the patterns and situations that put me in a place of being, say, sarcastic and snarky or critical. And it opens up, I hope, some possibilities for change behaviors. How about for y'all? Can you take a minute if anyone's had a fun experience with their bracelet this week or last week?
Fun experience?
What? A fun experience, a profound realization about the darkness of your soul. No, did anything? Yes.
I realized that when I'm driving bus, I yell at a lot of cars and
catch
the bus off.
I
had to switch it multiple times.
So, not while you're moving. Yeah. I'm hoping it's at the red light that you...
Okay.
So traffic seems to be the place where many people have had the biggest issues. Any non-traffic happenings? Yes.
I think this is kind of sad, but when I was talking with some of my friends and trying not to gossip, I couldn't participate in any of our conversations or
there's nothing to talk about. Wow, yeah, that's pretty amazing, isn't it? You end up watching much more carefully. Yeah, thank you.
Ah. It was just a nice reminder of why it was there, and I finally took it off. I'm sorry, but it was all faded and nasty from being in the shower and in the pool.
Sure. Yeah.
I need another one.
Well, we've got it there for you. I saw one more. Yes.
Being critical, we all have a tendency to get higher expectations of yourself and other people.
Yeah. So we can move the bracelets from being just a thought-provoking gimmick to really changed behavior by sticking with it for the next couple of weeks. Behavioral psychologists say it takes 4 to 6 weeks of practice to change some small behaviors. You can't change monster behaviors that quickly, but you can create a new habit in 4 to 6 weeks. Last spring, Barb and I got to learn how to start a practice. We set up a goal to ride our bicycles down to the annual conference down in Manchester, New Hampshire, and we decided that we would get our post-50 bodies into slightly better condition by bicycling, either depending on the loop, either 12 or 20 miles before breakfast, early in the morning. It was terrible. The first week was miserable, but it was always also fun because it was new and novel, and I'm ADD, so new and novel is wonderful, even if it hurts. The second week was, okay, this is really early, this is work, but we can do it. And then the third week was the test. We had 2 days in a row where it was raining heavily in the morning and we didn't go out because it just didn't seem like we had to do that to the bikes. Really, we were protecting the bikes. And we skipped the ride, we stayed in bed, and it was warm, and it was snuggly, and it was wonderful, and we thought, oh, this is really nice. And then the next day, we woke up, and in the dim sunlight, we could see there was sunlight. There was no rain. And through half-closed eyes, we had to make a tough decision. Do we have another wonderful, warm, snuggly morning in bed, or do we greet the sun and the cold June morning with a pre-breakfast ride and get back on it? And it really felt like that decision that morning would make or break our new exercise ritual. If we slept in, it was going to all be over. If we got up, it would be ingrained. And by golly, we got up. We rode, and we kept it up, and we did the ride to Manchester, and you all made it worthwhile by helping us raise a big chunk of money for the Imagine No Malaria campaign, and it was awesome, and thank you so much for your generosity. So that was a cool thing. It takes some weeks to create some new behaviors, the habit ones, the easy ones. Some changes, deeper changes, take a lot longer. They require a bunch of tries and a bunch of failings and then trying again and then falling down again and then getting up again and then missing the mark again and then trying again. Sometimes the new behaviors are so critical that you can't be thinking in the future about what a difference this new behavior is going to make for me in a month or a year or a decade from now. It is just one day at a time. Make it through this hour. Make it through this minute without that drink or without that cigarette or without cutting myself. Without listening to the internal tape recorder that says, "You're a loser, no one really loves you, you aren't worth it." The word for that day-to-day getting up, getting through it, is not strength. The word is not perseverance. The word is not even steadfastness. Those words are too big, too confident, too raw. I can do this no matter the obstacles. I am strong. That's not how most of us meet the challenges of changed behavior. The word, rather, is resilience, which is quieter and less forceful, and usually makes a deeper change over the long haul. Keith Collins writes about how steadfast and resilient are very different attributes. He writes, "Steadfast is a measure of willpower. Resilience is a measure of emotional power. Steadfast is about resisting change and holding firm. Resilience flows effortlessly between obstacles." I'm a visual person, so for me it was, "Steadfast is Dick Butkus." You have to be of a certain age. "Resilience is Mercury Morris." People over 50 are going, "Oh, I got it, all right." "Steadfast is Rocky Balboa." "Resilient is Bruce Lee." "Steadfast is the rock that will not be moved." "Resilience is the water that flows around it." Both resiliency and steadfastness are necessary ingredients in a life of faith. The core truth of our being beloved of the God whom we meet in Jesus Christ is a steadfast rock to which we can cling. But how we live out that belovedness in a rapidly, radically changing world, that takes resilient grace, day to day, hour to hour, minute to minute. And it's not about how we are. It's about how open we are to what God is doing in the moment. The stories we read at Advent and Christmas are about being open to what God is doing in the moment. Resilience. Stories about people given a vision, a direction, whether a dream of an angel or a star in the east or a babe to be born. It's about the circuitous, changing, flexible, sometimes exasperating and dangerous paths that they take, but always faithful paths that they take, even when they take a 180-degree turn. A path they take to get to the vision, to get to the dream, to get to the babe in the manger. Eugene Peterson, who gave us the paraphrase of the Bible called The Message, he calls such a life of faith a life of resiliency. He calls it a long obedience in the same direction. Mary is asked to abandon her planned quiet life as an ordinary Galilean peasant girl to give birth to one who would pull the mighty down from their thrones, one who would somehow be a perfect window into the very heart of God. Joseph, as a male in a patriarchal culture, has to say yes to the abuse and the shame that will be heaped upon him if he says yes to the dream of taking Mary as his bride. Magi get a hint in the sky of something big in the east. Or for them, the west. Mary, Joseph, Elizabeth, Zechariah, the Magi, the shepherds are thrust into situations where being steady and status quo are going against the will of God. When their lives are turned upside down, they had to be open and awake to the new thing, the strange thing, the possibly dangerous thing that God is doing in their midst. They are not steadfast. They are resilient. The hardest thing for us as moderns, when we hear their stories, is that their resiliency happens in the midst of suffering. The threat of stoning, of shame, of homelessness, of being a refugee family in Egypt, of watching innocent children killed because of your child, of watching your child nailed to a cross. It's hard for us to hear because modernity lifts up comfort as the highest good. We want convenience, we want now. And the thought of suffering for a vision makes little to no sense to us. The Bible does not offer comfort as the highest good. It offers a long obedience in the same direction as the highest good. Matthew's story and Luke's story both give us powerful illustrations of what it is to be resilient. In Luke's story of the birth of Christ, Luke always takes great pains to let us know that when God is revealing God's self in the world, it is in the most unexpected and lowly of places. It's in a peasant girl from Nazareth, in a nothing town, in a nowhere province on the edge of empire. She sings a song of the powerful being pulled down from their thrones, the hungry lifted up and filled. The angels bring good news to the poorest of the poor, shepherds abiding in the fields. Shepherds were not a romantic living in those days. Shepherds were the people who could do nothing else. And they were considered drunks, and their sexual proclivities with sheep was a little... But that's the one to who, the ones to whom God comes to give the good news. The angels come and say, hey, yo, there's a baby born. Come check it out. Suffering. The Lord of Lords is born in a cave. The King of Kings is laid in a cow's trough for a bed. The author of the cosmos is as poor and impoverished and powerless and vulnerable as can be. And Mary says yes to all that. That's not steadfastness. That's resilience. That's not standing still or standing steady. It's being open to a radical new thing that God's doing. In Matthew's story, he's always taking great pains to let us know that when God is revealing God's self in the world, it makes the powerful quake. The heavens declare the coming birth. Magi, who are politically powerful Persian priests, how's that for alliteration, and astronomers from the east, undertake this long, arduous journey. And Herod and others who benefit from an unjust power structure are scared, and they respond with the tools they know best. Strength, violence, terror, force, and power. They think they're being steadfast. The Herods, the chief priests, the scribes. It's the Magi. It's Joseph, who are resilient. T.S. Eliot wrote a wonderful poem about the Magi's journey being seen, recollected years later. And it's not a romantic watercolor poem. It's called Hard Journey, and it goes, the beginning goes like this. A cold coming we had of it, just the worst time of the year for a journey, and such a journey, the ways deep and the weather sharp, the very dead of winter, and the camels galled, sore-footed, refractory, lying down in the melting snow. There were times we regretted the summer palaces on slopes, the terraces, and the silken girls bringing sherbet. Then the camel men cursing and grumbling and running away and wanting their liquor and their women and the night fires going out and the lack of shelters and the cities hostile and the towns unfriendly and the villages dirty and charging high prices. A hard time we had of it. They made it through not by steadfastness, staying where they were, but by resilience. They kept their eyes on one thing, a star in the west. But the paths they took were circuitous. They found, in fact, the one time they took their eyes off the star and went to Herod to inquire about the child, they were steered entirely wrong. And it took, again, a dream. Matthew was very big on dreams, to warn them to go home by still another way. I wonder what that one looked like. Resilience. Resilience. It's hard for moderns to hear that following God's unexpected voice or vision leads to suffering. It's not what our culture values. Anne Morrow Lindbergh, in her marriage to Charles Lindbergh, learned a bit of what suffering is. And she wrote once about it. She said, "What I am saying here is not simply the old Puritan truism that suffering teaches. I do not believe that sheer suffering teaches. If suffering alone taught, then all the world would be wise because everyone suffers. To suffering must be added mourning, understanding, patience, love, openness, and the willingness to remain vulnerable. All these and other factors combined, if the circumstances are right, can teach and can lead to rebirth. That is resilience." Every meaningful relationship we have needs resilience. A friendship needs resilience because friends mess up and they'll disappoint and they'll let you down. And resilience calls us to keep the connections, to suffer, to learn, to forgive, and to move on. And we pray that when you mess up and let down, they offer the same resilient grace to you. We can name so many other things that need resilient grace: friendships, community, marriage, a church, a collection of ordinary folk who mess up and fall short and let you down, sometimes quietly. When it's the pastor who messes up or lets you down, it's up front and there's a spotlight. But we all depend on resilient grace for forgiveness, learning, and moving on. As our churches are in wild new places, wild new times, where the old ways of being church don't work anymore, it's tempting, and a lot of Christians are doing it. They're working on steadfast. We're not gonna move. We're gonna keep doing this the way we've always done it. Come hell or high water. In times that are fearsome, our culture is saying the same thing. We have presidential candidates who are more than happy for you to be steadfast in not changing a thing. Follow your fear. Follow your prejudice. Stick with your tribe. Don't open up. Circle the wagons. When there's a vision of God saying, open up. Open up to the folks who are escaping war. Open up to the folks who do not have a homeland. Open up to those who hurt. Open up to those who are hungry. And I'm so proud of this congregation that that is the vision you all have. It's resiliency. And it causes suffering. Sometimes small stuff. Fourth Fridays can be a pain in the neck. Fifth Sundays can be chaotic. But it's resiliency and it's a long obedience in the same direction. Our calling is not to be steadfast. Our calling is to be resilient. Our calling is not to be strong. Is to know where our strength lies and where our source is for strength. I've shared a bunch of times about some of my experiences when I was in seminary and I was a live-in volunteer at a halfway house for mentally ill adults. And I joke that It was really good practice for church, but I don't mean it, not in the way you think. The good practice for church, besides the crazy, was that that was a place that was always being beset by change and chaos and fear. Someone decompensates and goes nutty. Someone takes all their pills and tries to kill themselves. Someone runs off, doesn't show up at work, and we have no idea where they are for a week. And more suicide attempts than I can put on one hand or two hands. It was not a place of steadfastness. It was not a place of strength. But it was a community that worked because they loved and they forgave and they held each other up. And when one of them fell down or screwed up or betrayed, there was forgiveness, there was re-welcoming, there was resilience. No one in that house was strong, especially the volunteers. But it was good practice for church because we learned how to live and love out of a place of weakness. This Advent, I'm praying that I can make my journey through without needing to be strong, because I know where my strength lies. I can be resilient rather than steadfast, because I know who is steadfast. And that's the God we meet in the babe in Bethlehem, and the God we pray will come through to fulfill history. And our job is to keep our eyes open for whatever new, maybe scary thing that God has in store for us as resilient and loving people.